From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! It's Super Tuesday, a defining day for Republican frontrunner Bob Dole. Texas and Florida are the big-ticket states, and Texas will look at the growing power of the Christian Coalition. We'll speak with Cecile Richards, daughter of former Governor Ann Richards, about her work with the Texas Freedom Network, which challenges the political influence of religious conservatives. Also, President Clinton signs the Helms-Burton bill, strengthening the U.S. embargo on Cuba. We'll tell you what the new law will do and how it's being received in Miami on the day of the Florida primary. That and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. It's a big day today. It's called Super Tuesday, with primaries throughout the South and in Oregon. And we're going to be talking about two of those biggest primaries, Texas and Florida. Then we're going to the daughter of former Governor Ann Richards, and we'll be talking about what's going on in that state in terms of the Christian Coalition. Finally, we'll be joined by a New York Congressmember, Charles Rangel, who has been opposing the strict Helms-Burton bill that's going to be signed at 10 o'clock this morning by President Clinton. And if anyone doesn't think that President Clinton is campaigning, think again. Let's not forget that today one of the big primary states is Florida, and a new Mason-Dixon poll finds 52% of likely Republican voters in Florida support Dole. Publisher Steve Forbes follows with 17%. Pat Buchanan is below that with 13%. And it looks like President Clinton, in looking at Florida, is trying very much to get new appreciation from Cuban exiles who generally vote Republican. We'll be talking about the significance of that with a Florida resident as well as the congressman. But before we do all that, we're going to Texas, one of the biggest states, extremely significant when it comes to these primaries. Larry Bensky, our national affairs correspondent, is down in Texas. Texas, an interesting state, has some interesting figures. I was just looking at a recent New Republic article that talks about Texas as having the fourth highest poverty rate in the country. One-fifth of its people are below poverty, with especially large numbers of poor children and immigrants. In AFDC and Medicaid payments, Texas routinely ranks 48th in the nation. In state spending per capita, it's last in the country. And in terms of prison spending, after an eight-year, $2 billion debt-financed building binge, Texas has one of the biggest prison systems in the world. Joining us to talk about the Texas primary and its significance is Larry Bensky. Larry, are you there?
Hello, Amy. Yes, I am.
It's nice to hear you in our Houston studios at KPFT.
Yes, back here at KPFT, one of KPFA and KPFB and WBAI and KPFK and WPFW. These are the Pacifica stations.
And we welcome them all, by the way, to Democracy Now! And thank all the listeners who've been calling in and writing to our email sites, giving us suggestions, giving us headlines from their papers. And we encourage you to keep on doing that. We'll be giving you the email address at the end of the show. So, Larry, what's happening in Texas?
Well, Amy, it's interesting that you led off by talking about the poverty and all the poverty in this state, and it's really quite visible. I've been, as you know, in southeast Texas for the last few days in the area around Beaumont and Galveston, and that's very much still a part of the South. When you go to the poor side of town, which is, of course, the same thing as saying the African-American side of town or the Latino side of town, you see people living as they lived 40 or 50 years ago in Mississippi and Alabama in very, very ramshackle housing, very, very poor public transportation, rundown public facilities like schools and parks. It's clear that the two-tier economy, which we see so much in the rest of the United States, is especially visible in the rural areas, but even in the urban areas on what is literally in Beaumont, Texas, the other side of the tracks, where people are living in obvious and visible poverty.
Why don't you introduce our guest that we have on the line with us from Texas, someone who knows well the political climate there and has decided to challenge it.
Yes, it's a great pleasure to have us with us today on Democracy Now!, Amy. Geraldine Sam, who is running for Congress today, she's on the ballot here in Texas, where we are having a statewide primary, not only for the presidential race on the Republican side, but also to decide who will be running in the various Democratic and Republican contests in the Senate, in Congress, and in the local races as well. Geraldine Sam is a school teacher, an elementary school teacher in Lamarck, Texas, which is next to Galveston. It's part of the very large 9th Congressional District, which has, how many square miles does it have, Geraldine Sam? Somebody told me some amazing figure.
Oh, wow. It's huge. We've driven it so much right now that, I mean, it's just a huge district. We drive over at least about 200 miles almost every other day, covering the whole district.
Well, I can tell you that it is huge. It's at least 100 miles long at its widest part. It goes from the suburbs of the city of Houston all the way to the Louisiana border. Beaumont is the largest city in the district, but it has 114,000 people. Congressional districts in the United States now have something like 550,000 people in them, so the rest of the 400,000 people are somewhere around the district. Geraldine Sam, in addition to being a candidate for Congress, so when she's not doing that, she's an elementary school teacher. She is a mother of four children, a single mother. She is someone who has had not an easy life herself. She's definitely a working class person who's worked her way up to the place she now is, and is trying to work her way up even further into the United States Congress. Should she win the nomination in the 9th Congressional District, she'll be running against one of the most conservative Republicans in Congress, and that's Steve Stockman, who replaced Jack Brooks. Many listeners may remember him, the crusty, cigar-smoking member, chair of the House Judiciary Committee, who was in Congress until he was defeated for 42 years. Geraldine Sam, let's go back to what Amy Goodman started asking about before, the question of poverty and social inequality in Texas. How do you see this in your district?
Absolutely. One of the problems that we have in the 9th Congressional District is the 9th Congressional District is one of those areas where you have a lot of poverty. You have a lot of people that we have a lot of problems with water, air pollution, and so many other things that are affecting the quality of life in the 9th Congressional District. You have many people here that can't read nor write, and you have some that can, but most of them you're having a problem with in that area. It's a very diverse area, never a dull moment.
Well, how have things changed in your lifetime? You're a woman, I think it's safe to say, somewhere in her mid-40s, is that correct?
Right, 44.
44, okay, that's even more precise. Okay, proud to be 44.
Yeah.
And you've lived in the area where you now teach and work your entire life.
Mm-hmm.
How have things changed as this state has grown from more and more Democratic majority state to a more and more Republican majority? Some people say that that's just been changing a label, that the politicians have always been conservative politicians. They used to call themselves Democrats. They now call themselves Republicans, and it really doesn't make any difference. Is that true? How do you see it?
Well, I feel that right now there is a game of a perception of fairness. We've been taught all of our lives that life is fair, and you're going to be fair with other people. And as we've been on the campaign trail and throughout my lifetime, I found out that life is really not fair, and the election process is not fair.
In what way is it unfair?
Well, even with us with the campaign, we've sent in editorials. I mean, not editorials, but we've sent in endorsements to the papers, and never had them published in the papers. So far, they wanted to just harp on my opponent as being a front runner, and yet and still they ignored the fact that 2 years ago I ran, and we had 33% of the vote 2 years ago, and so that gave us automatically name recognition, whether we had the money or not. That gave us name ID. And so those facts were ignored So there's a lot of unfairness that played in this election.
Geraldine, Sam, can we talk about money for a second?
Sure.
Can we talk about how you get your money? For example,
sure.
Is the Democratic Party giving your money? Are they seeing Steve Stockman as one of the most conservative candidates, one of the key targets in Congress? And groups like Emily's List, for example, that give women candidates money around the country.
Well, Emily's List, and we were endorsed by the National Women's Political Caucus, and unfortunately, we didn't actually aggressively go after Emily's List money. I think that we went after them a little bit later. But it's just really a difficult situation, because when the Democratic Party the Democratic Party has a tendency to anoint someone, okay, that they feel is the right person for the district. And unfortunately, the person that they anointed for this race is not the person or the choice of the people. I am.
Well, let me just answer that, Amy, in a way. We'll give you some statistics. Geraldine Sam, whom we're talking to here, is going to spend, as I understand it, less than $15,000 in her primary campaign. Is that approximately correct?
That's correct.
And the man who has been anointed, as Geraldine Sam says, as the front runner, says he's going to spend something around $300,000 in this primary season. And then there is another man in the race who's self-financing his campaign, and he apparently is going to spend something like $250,000, $250,000. So she's being outspent by 10-1 or better.
That's
in this
correct.
Primary season.
Is the issue of militias coming up? Steve Stockman is known as one who has close ties to militias.
Oh, absolutely. The people in the 9th Congressional District want a Congress person that is not totally consumed by the issue of the militias, and one that they can be proud of. And right now, they're really, truly concerned about a congressperson that has that kind of close ties to an organization that is racially motivated.
How closely tied is he?
From what we're gathering with the media, he's very closely tied. Has been at some functions that they've held, saw some of his material at some of those functions. So very closely tied from what we're gathering.
The incident, Amy, that brought Steve Stockman's ties to the militia out was when he received a fax the day of the Oklahoma City bombing from some of the people who were tipping him off about it, a fax that he promptly turned over to the Justice Department. But the question was raised, why is Steve Stockman, of all the people in the United States, getting a communication from militias on a day like this? I spoke to some Christian Coalition activists yesterday, Geraldine Sam, in Beaumont, the largest city in the district, and they were telling me that they believe Steve Stockman accurately reflects the anger in society against delinquency, against crime, against the loss of moral values, and they thought that they had, again, a winning candidate. If you're nominated, how are you going to counter their arguments?
Well, we're going to counter it because, number one, I am an educator and have been out in the forefront. And so you're going to find that Geraldine Sam is one that has worked with the people, and he's going to have to show that what he has truly done, not just by saying it. He's going to have to definitely show where he's not involved, because we're all Americans, and I think that it's time that race no longer be a part or an issue in any race. Again, that's one of those problems that we're having to face today, and I'm hoping that in at least my lifetime or my children's lifetime that we'll have an America that is not so conscious of the race issue.
And again,
Amy, wanted to point out to you, Amy, and also to the other listeners, that the district we're talking about is a traditionally Democratic district. It's a very heavily working-class district. There's a lot of union activity. It's an oil well district, a lot of refineries and people who work in them and shipping and things like that. It's traditionally been very heavily unionized. And the unions can be expected, can't they, Geraldine Sam, to get behind the eventual Democratic winner of this primary and serve as foot soldiers, precinct walkers, etc.?
Right. And one of the things that we're with our campaign that has made it so successful is because we have a lot of grassroots people that are working with the campaign. Many of them don't have a lot of money to provide to us, but they are giving us the footwork, the grassroots. And we have a very diverse group of people that are working with us, blacks, whites, Hispanic, Asians. We have just a little bit of everyone. So we have a melting pot that's supporting our candidacy. And again, we don't have the money, but we have the grassroots support. And that's even what gave us our 33% 2 years ago, even when people thought that a lot of it was anti-Brooks support, but much of it was Geraldine Sam support.
Geraldine Sam, what about voter registration drives? How intensively is the Democratic Party trying to register more Democratic voters? You know, I'm asking because about a week ago we interviewed Loretta Ross, who is from the Center for Human Rights Education,
right,
Atlanta, Georgia. And she was complaining that the Democratic Party never took the candidate who opposed Newt Gingrich seriously or put any effort into helping him in his battle there. And I'm just wondering how seriously the Democratic Party is focusing on Steve Stockman. I mean, when you have a candidate that is only won once, that is the key time to go after him. After he has won the second time, he is more likely to stay in Congress. His percentage points go way up there. How seriously is the Democratic Party trying to get more Democrats on the voter rolls?
Well, let me say this, that the Democratic Party is going to have to step up because the Steve Stockman people have, they've been on the radio airways. Their people stay on the radio airways. They stay in the editorial section writing letters to the editor. They're always using any form of media that they can. And I think that that's where they've outbeat everyone. It wasn't the amount of money that they used, but it was the resources that they used, and that was much of the media. And they're always writing letters to the editor. You'll find all of those in your newspapers between here and Beaumont and Port Arthur, where they're writing in support of him or writing about an issue that he might, for instance, the Kinsey list or something. I thought that was just, I couldn't see even where my congressman was going on that issue of the Kinsey report. But
let me explain that if I could, because it's kind of an interesting sidelight to the kind of mentality that we get on the far right these days. One of the resolutions that Steve Stockman introduced into Congress, and by the way, he's had no bill that he's introduced this year get any further than committee, was H.R. 2749, which is a bill to determine if Alfred Kinsey's sexual behavior in the human male and female is the result of any fraud or criminal wrongdoing. Now, when you talk to some people about this on the Christian right, which I have down here, they say that they believe that the whole question of sex education in schools is part of a basic humanist plot to defeat the Word of God and take biblical orientation away from the population of the United States. And Steve Stockman wanted an investigation into this, 40 or 50-year-old scientific text to determine if it was part of this conspiracy. That's what this is all about.
So,
you're speechless, Amy.
Larry, we're going to have to wrap up, but I wanted to get from you just a thumbnail sketch of what you think is going to happen today in Texas and whether George Bush Jr. has been playing any key role in the Republican primary in Texas.
Well, the Republican primary in Texas is not a very happening thing because, of course, Bob Dole is presumed to be the front runner. He's going to take many delegates if he doesn't get them all. I think much more interesting is the kind of race that Geraldine Sam is involved in. If she or someone else in that district does not get 50% in today's voting, there'll be a runoff on April 9th. And that's true for the Democratic nomination for senator, for whoever's going to face Phil Graham as well. Equally interesting, Amy, and this is something that people around the United States don't know, as the balloting ends tonight in every precinct in Texas, Democrats and Republicans separately gather for precinct caucuses, at which point they introduce resolutions that they want their state committee to bring to the national convention. This is where the Christian right has really been organizing, and you can talk about this with Cecile Richards in a few minutes, to see if they can get anti-abortion resolutions, pro-school prayer resolutions, homeschooling resolutions, and who knows, Kinsey Report resolutions introduced into the national platform.
Resolutions are a little bit of everything, trust me. I've been there. Been there and done that.
Right. And so these resolutions will then be part of an ongoing ideological debate within the Republican Party. Now, of course, very few people turn up for these precinct caucuses. And so the Christian right, if they can turn out 5, 10, 20 people per precinct, can carry that precinct in these positions, even if the people in the district wouldn't vote for it in a million years.
Larry, on that note, and Geraldine Sam, we want to thank you both very much for joining us. Geraldine Sam, a kindergarten teacher and mother, African-American Democratic candidate for the 9th Congressional District in Texas. She hopes
we'll have the result of that.
Steve Stockman.
Sorry, maybe I was going to say, we'll have the result of that race and much more tomorrow morning.
That's right. And Larry Bensky, Pacifica's National Affairs Correspondent, thanks for joining us from Houston. You're listening to Democracy Now! Up next, Cecile Richards. She's the daughter of Ann Richards. Coming up. You're listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Democracy Now! Is Pacifica Radio's daily national grassroots election show. Just following up on the comment about Phil Gramm, the senator from Texas, and Harper's Index last week, the rank of Phil Gramm among senators who missed the largest number of floor votes last year. He is number one. Also, an interesting piece in the Wall Street Journal today, Dole campaign has paid over $1 million to firm that uses telemarketing to criticize opponents. And it's a piece out of Springfield, Illinois, where an operation called Campaign Tell Limited has hundreds of employees who make calls to people, residents of different primary states, pretending that they're doing national marketing research. In fact, they're working for Bob Dole, and they're putting out misinformation and negative information about other candidates. A telephone script that's highlighted says, "I'm calling with a special message from Iowa's farm families. Iowa's Farm Bureau has adopted a resolution that opposes the flat tax like the one offered by candidate Steve Forbes. Under the Forbes flat tax, Iowa's farmers would pay an average of $5,000 more in taxes." Some of the people that were interviewed for this piece say that they often say they're from the Farm Bureau. And when the candidate, Senate Majority Leader Bob Dole, issued his denial that he was making any phone calls when Forbes complained in the Iowa caucuses, in fact, the State Journal Register of Springfield issued some of these campaign phone scripts. And they said things like, "Usually we do stuff for Dole. He's our major client. That's the company that does this work. Again, he's spending $1 million to put out false information or negative information about other candidates, but he denies he's doing it." Piece in the Wall Street Journal today. Well, we're going to stick with Texas for a little while, and then we're going to Florida, and we're going to be talking about what President Clinton is doing this morning, signing the Helms-Burton bill, which tightens the stranglehold on Cuba. We're going to be talking with New York Congressmember Charles Rangel, and we're going to be speaking with a Florida resident to find out how Cuban Americans are responding to President Clinton's signing of the bill. But right now, sticking with Texas, we're joined by Cecile Richards, daughter of former Texas Governor Ann Richards, who lost in 1994 to George Bush Jr. Cecile heads up a group called the Texas Freedom Network, which tracks right-wing activity in the state and organizes opposition to Christian coalition dominance in local politics and school boards. She's based in Austin, Texas. Thanks for joining us, Cecile Richards.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
Well, why don't you tell us what your group is doing?
Well, we started a year ago, sort of in the wake of the 94 elections here in Texas, to try to provide our sort of mainstream alternative to the far right in Texas, and particularly the religious right. And what we did is organize community and religious leaders around the state of Texas in order to be more involved in public policy issues and speaking out about how other people of faith feel about what the Christian Coalition is doing.
What specifically are they doing at the school board level?
Well, I mean, they have nationally have targeted the public education system to take it over, both at the state level in Texas, at the State Board of Education, and also local school boards. I went to a training in Atlanta last year, sponsored by the National Christian Coalition, on how to have religious extremists take over school boards locally. And they are, in my mind, they're really using our children as the pawns in this political movement to try to push their political agenda into the public schools.
You know, just yesterday we were talking to guests in Tennessee and also in Mississippi. And in Tennessee, they're going through this whole battle about bringing creationism back into the schools,
right,
and banning the teaching of evolution. Is that happening in Texas?
Well, it's happening not at the state level, but sort of more in a school district by school district level, and in their attempts to introduce creationist texts as alternatives, as they say, teach all the theories of creation and evolution. I think that that's just the tip of the iceberg, and frankly, that's what gets the most news coverage. But it's a more insidious kind of censorship of textbooks and materials and the kind of intolerance I think they bring to the agenda that is what really worries us in Texas.
Can you talk about some specific cases?
Well, I think we have several school boards that were either taken over by the religious right or have had members elected, and the difficulty is they are so bent on creating hysteria about the public education system, and I think making people very fearful of it, and really obsessing on a few sort of hot button issues, that it makes it very difficult for school districts who are already pretty much overwhelmed by their responsibilities to get anything done. And I think that's the real danger. I mean, I think that truly their mission is not just to get their agenda in the schools, but is to really dismantle public education as we know it in this country.
Now, often when people think of Christian Coalition candidates or advocates, you pretty much know what their position is. But the way they run, what we've seen around the country, is as stealth candidates. Why do they do that? How do you identify them?
Well, Ralph Reed himself was the mastermind of the stealth candidacy back in California. And although he doesn't talk about it much, it's clearly a part of what they do. And the reason they don't acknowledge their affiliation with groups like the Christian Coalition or the Eagle Forum or American Family or all the groups that we see here in Texas is because what we have shown in the state of Texas, at least, is that when voters know about folks' politics and they know, regardless of their political party, they don't like to elect people, particularly the school board, who are extreme in their views. And I think it's just like Pat Buchanan, I think they have a very small margin they can work in, and beyond that, they have no appeal.
Mm-hmm. The American Family Association, the Eagle Forum, Concerned Women of America, can you talk a little more about these groups? I mean, certainly our listeners around the country, I think they've heard about Phyllis Schlafly's Eagle Forum, but exactly what are they doing these days?
Well, it's really fascinating. I feel like I've had sort of a one-year crash course in what the far right is doing in the country, and I mean, a year ago, I couldn't have told you who Beverly LaHaye or the Concerned Women for America was, but in fact, they're the largest women's organization in the country with a $10 million annual budget, and they are extremely focused on public education and implementing things that they're concerned about. Like most of these groups, most of their agenda focuses on gays, on abortion, on other issues I think that they find they can move their membership and raise money on. Same with American Family Association, which is very active here in Texas, the Eagle Forum. I think the other disturbing trend we're seeing, and I think this is really a characteristic of the far right nationally, is that they have become much more focused on electoral politics and, frankly, much more sophisticated. Most of the groups I just mentioned are actively fielding candidates now for either the state house, the State Board of Education, or local school board races in the state. Mm.
I was just looking at an issue of Out Magazine that does a piece on Austin, Texas, and on a fledgling gay paper there called The Texas Triangle, and how the Christian right has been pressuring local mainstream businesses to withdraw their support from the paper. Do you know about this case?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, we sort of got both feet into it immediately. Because what happened was essentially the American Family Association decided that they would try to put the Texas Triangle out of business, which is, and the Triangle is a pretty mainstream newspaper that is in the gay community. And they started reading out over the radio, over the Christian radio, the names of all businesses that advertise in the Triangle, and encouraging their people not only to not shop there, but to harass these businesses, picket them. And it was, you know, all done in the name of supposedly of Christianity. And so we got involved as a community because it seemed it was very important that the gay community not be the only ones that had to fight this fight. And so brought together clergy, brought together other organizations that were not, you know, focused on gay issues particularly, to say this is outrageous. We can't let any group in our city or our state be maligned and attacked by the far right and not stand up. And we actually organized what was called a buy-in, where we sent out a list, a please patronize list to all of our folks, and did a press conference and really encouraged people to actively go and shop at these businesses to counteract the boycott. And the result is, I think, that the boycott was a total disaster, both in public relations terms and also in their effort to get the magazine put out of business.
We're talking to Cecile Richards, who is the head of the Texas Freedom Network, which tracks right-wing activity in the state and organizes opposition to Christian coalition dominance in local politics. Every Tuesday here on Democracy Now! Is Right Wing Watch, and we will continue to do this kind of work. What about the governor of your state who beat your mother, Ann Richards, Governor George Bush? How does he fit into the Christian coalition picture?
Well, I think, frankly, he's a pretty moderate governor, and I think he is in the position that other moderate Republicans are, which is in a very uncomfortable place. When we see that this, the religious right or the far right, and certainly in the state of Texas, is the most influential lobbying group within the party. They've taken over the state Republican Party. It makes it very difficult for people who are trying to reach consensus, bipartisan consensus on public policy issues. I don't know the man personally, but I would assume he is concerned about, you know, this sort of position that they put him in. And I think that's a concern nationally, is that, I mean, I think you're going to see more and more bad decisions being made by people who wouldn't normally do, you know, make bad public policy, because this is the loudest and most influential group within the Republican Party.
What about the National Rifle Association? Does it play any role, have any relationship with the Christian Coalition?
You know, I don't know in terms of their organizations what they share with each other. They have not, you know, that's not a group that we've dealt with very much, although I did find it sort of interesting. The Christian Coalition just sent out their scorecard for voters for the election, and one of the issues they asked all of the school board and state board of education candidates is how they felt about gun control, which you sort of wonder what that's related to in terms of public education. So I would say that in terms of their orientation on Second Amendment and on gun control, they probably share a lot of the same views as the National Rifle Association. I frankly think they're much more effective in Texas, though, than the NRA.
You know, speaking about guns and murder, last year when we were doing 100 Days of Congress, covering Congress for the 104th Congress first 100 days, we were following Dick Armey in the House after his comment about Barney Frank, that's how he said it. And we're looking at his record. He has never supported gay or lesbian civil rights in the Congress. And we were looking back to his district in Texas and to all of Texas. There was a very interesting piece last year in Vanity Fair documenting the trail of brutal gay murders, murders of gay men. Now, all murder is brutal, but it wasn't just that they were knifed one or two times, but they were knifed more than 100 times. And it was clearly tremendously, you know, related to the hate of gays and lesbians in the state. What about the issue of gay murders, and what has the Christian Coalition said about it, since so many of them have been unsolved?
Well, I, you know, they, it's, you know, what they say about it is always one of those questions. It depends on if you talk to Ralph Reed or Pat Robertson, you know, and I think that the Christian Coalition has done a very good good job of masking the real hateful rhetoric that is used on the 700 Club and on some of their direct mail appeals, because they have Ralph Reed then go and be the sort of the reasonable front. I'm sickened by what I see in the state of Texas in terms of their attitude towards gay people and their obsession, frankly, with what people do in their private lives. I'm frankly at a loss to figure out groups that ostensibly are their purpose is to set out about, you know, sort of bringing good Christian values to this country, and then all I see them do is malign people who are doing them no harm, and that includes American Family and the other groups too. We've had a real fight, and some ministers in Houston have really taken the lead on trying to expose how the hateful rhetoric of people like Pat Robertson leads to hateful activity, whether it's murder or harassment. And I just think it's unconscionable for a group that claims they are about good Christian values.
We were just talking to Geraldine Sam, who is running for Congress in the 9th District in Texas, and she was saying how she has no access to the newspapers there. How does the mainstream press in Texas deal with the Texas Freedom Network? Do they put out your information? Do they cover your events, your strategies?
Well, I have to say I'm pretty pleased. I mean, one of the reasons we started a year ago was that I think folks were so sick of reading about the Christian Coalition and other groups, and there was nothing on the other side. And so I think that one of the things we try to do is fill a void there and make sure that whenever one of these religious or far-right groups is covered, that there is a response and there's an alternative. So I actually feel like, at least in this last year, that there's a growing understanding of two things. One, by the press, that there is an alternative. And second, that what we're dealing with is not a religious issue. This is a political movement that we're dealing with. And I think it's taken some time to educate them that the Christian Coalition has nothing to do with religion or Christianity. It is an electorally oriented political national movement that has just conveniently or intentionally, I think, misused religious terms to really mask what they're doing. And I think that the press has got to take more of a role in understanding that and educating the rest of the people in this country.
Today is Super Tuesday. Of course, you've got the primary in Texas, and Larry Bensky, our national affairs correspondent, was just telling us about the caucuses that are also held today throughout the state of Texas, where the Christian coalition, because so few people come out, actually dominate. Can you talk about what happens at these caucuses?
Well, I think it determines who controls the party, not only and who will go to the national convention. The Christian Coalition has spent an incredible amount of money and time this year in trying to get all of their members to both run for precinct chair, which is the first line of defense there, and also to introduce several resolutions that they've sent out across the state of Texas, most of which I think your listeners would find pretty repulsive. And I think it's true. It's the way they took over the Republican Party, and it's really an organizational question. And they are very, very focused on it. They've held training sessions all over the state of Texas in order to get people to run for a precinct chair and take over the precinct at that level. And I think it's interesting. I think folks think of the Christian Coalition as being strictly affiliated with the Republican Party, but it's clear in 96th cycle, they are making a concerted effort to have the same type of influence in the Democratic Party.
The defeat of Phil Graham and his pulling out, has this been a blow for the Christian Coalition in Texas?
No, I don't really think so. I mean, it's a blow for us, actually. After I heard that he had missed more votes than anyone else, I was thinking, God, I don't know what we'll do when he's actually there to vote. Hello?
Yes, we're talking to Cecile Richards. She's head of the Texas Freedom Network, and we're just finishing up the discussion. Are you still there, Cecile?
Sorry about that. I lost you.
Oh, no.
Well, in any case, you were just asking about Phil Graham. I think that their sights are set on, the beauty of their organization is that they can almost claim victory for anything, and I don't think they had really invested that much in Graham's candidacy. And I think as soon as they saw that Pat Buchanan was not going to go anywhere, they cut and run on him and started sidling up to Bob Dole.
And in fact, do you think he is following through on all of the issues that are important to them. I mean, at these family and God rallies, he holds up his 100% rating for the Christian Coalition.
Right. Makes you wonder what it means to be moderate anymore. I think that the thing that disturbs me, or I guess my belief about politics, is that people in elective office are only as good as those people that are supporting them outside and advocating and allowing them to do the right thing. And I think the frightening thing about a Bob Dole candidacy is not that whatever his personal beliefs are going to be are really going to be outweighed by the influence of the Christian Coalition and other religious right organizations. And
Cecile, are you going to be following in your mother's footsteps? Are you going to be running for governor?
I've seen it. I've seen too much up close, to be honest. I think it's. I'm having a great time doing what I'm doing. But thanks for the question anyway.
The number people can contact the Texas Freedom Network to find out how you're organizing or if they want to be involved.
Sure.
In Texas?
Yeah, we had a lot of calls from around the country, and we'd be happy to talk to you. It's 512-322-0545, and that's Austin, Texas.
And that's 512-322-0545. I want to thank you very much for joining us.
Sure. Thanks
Cecile
for calling.
Richards, bye. Thanks. From the Texas Freedom Network. You're listening to Democracy Now! Up next, we take a look at Cuba and the Helms-Burton Act. We'll be joined by New York Congressmember Charles Rangel. You're listening to Democracy Now!, Pacifica Radio's daily grassroots election show, heard in states throughout the country, and we're hoping more states will be picking us up. Tell your friends to call their public radio stations, community radio stations, university radio stations, and ask those stations to run Pacifica's Democracy Now! Right now, we're turning southward. We're going to take a look at Florida and also Cuba on this day that President Clinton is signing the Helms-Burton Act at a White House ceremony. It was passed in response to Cuba's downing of two civilian planes last month. In addition to stricter sanctions, the bill also gives Cuban exiles the right to sue over property they lost during Fidel Castro's regime, and also anti-Castro feeling is strong among many Cuban exiles and immigrants in South Florida, one of the Super Tuesday primary states. Clinton is seeking new appreciation from Cuban exiles who generally vote Republican. Joining us to talk about this issue are three people. We're joined in Florida by Frank Manitzes, who is former Latin American Bureau Chief for ABC News. He's covered Cuban politics for 35 years. We're also joined by Jane Franklin, contributing editor to Cuba Update and author of The Cuban Revolution in the United States, a chronological history. And joining us from New York is New York Congressmember Charles Rangel, who's been quite outspoken on the issue of Cuba. We welcome you all to Democracy Now! Let's begin with Congressman Rangel. Your response today to President Clinton's signing of the Helms-Burton Act.
Well, the act is unenforceable. It's really an embarrassment to all of our trading partners to think that we can dictate to Mexico and to Canada and to Europe, Asia, as to whom they can trade with, and just refuse to allow them to come into the United States if indeed they're occupying property that at one time belonged to a Cuban-American here. But the sad thing is that the president said it was a bad bill before, and now because of the tragedy of Americans being shot down near or over Cuba, all of a sudden, it's become a political issue in a presidential year. And with all of the sympathy and appreciation I've had for those courageous pilots to risk their lives, I just don't believe that our foreign and trade policy should be governed by people who differ with the President of the United States or the Congress, for that matter.
Congressman, isn't this somehow a violation of the North American Free Trade Agreement to now go after Canada and to sanction and put obstacles in the way of Canadian trade, which does trade with Cuba?
What this really does is magnify all of the violations that America has committed in terms of international law. The embargo itself is violative of our own trade law as well as international law. And we're the only nation in the entire world that supports it. We constantly condemn. But the whole idea now that we will have extra legal authority over the jurisdiction of foreigners is absolutely a theory that is embarrassing. It is unenforceable, and nations that are kind to us just say that it's a stupid law and the president is in panic over attempting to pick up some votes in Florida. And others, of course, are not that gentle in just saying this is the working of an arrogant country that believes it can dictate its policy to the entire world. It's an embarrassment to us. This does not mean that I don't have a great deal of sympathy for those people seeking democracy in what could be considered their homeland. But for the president to take all of the power that we've given to him and to use it in this petty political way by signing this legislation, it degrades everything that we do as a nation. And certainly everything we do internationally. We are the laughing stock of the international community because we cannot enforce this law.
Congressman Rangel, we want to move south for a minute to Miami, where Frank Menitzes is standing by. Can you tell us, do you see the signing of this bill today, the Helms-Burton bill, as very much tied into the Florida primary that's taking place? And what are Cuban radio and leaders saying about the primary and the signing of the bill today?
Well, Congressman Rangel is correct. This so-called Libertad Act is really just a piece of graffiti, because I've never seen a law in the United States that includes so many paragraphs trying to justify why they are saying this should be a law, and it's all in those 40 pages, all single-spaced. But here, as you can imagine, the Cuban-American community that is vociferous is very much in favor of the bill. And President Clinton, who originally had planned to sign the bill on Wednesday, is doing it today, and this is taking all the spotlight away from the Republican primary that's going on here that Dole is expected to win. But the interesting thing is that neither Dole nor Forbes nor Buchanan are really suggesting anything stronger than what the president himself is doing. There have been some clips that go out by Pat Buchanan of we ought to try these people, says Bob Dole, and Buchanan says we ought to shoot them out of the sky, et cetera, et cetera. But they don't really mean that, and they laugh when they say it in a way. But here, it is serious business, and what it has done, unfortunately, it has put the Americans and the Cuban Americans who were seeking a change in Cuba, a peaceful change in Cuba, on the defensive, and now it's going to be much more difficult to have talks that could lead to that.
You know, it's interesting. It says, or polls show, that Bob Dole is ahead in Florida of Clinton when it comes to Cuban exiles and who they prefer. But in 1992, wasn't it candidate Clinton who signed first on to the so-called Cuba Democracy Act of New Jersey Congressman Robert Torricelli, forcing Bush to do the same? In fact, he has been much more out there on behalf of these Cuban Americans whose money he has taken for his campaign than any other candidate.
If you want to hear an inside story on that, during the Bush administration, I was asked by the Assistant Secretary of State whether or not I would debate the Torricelli bill on the floor, because the Bush administration was against it. I was surprised that a Republican administration would ask me to do it, but I guess they felt that it would be better that a Democrat would do it rather than they lose grace with the Cuban-Americans in Miami that were supporting the bill. And so I had agreed to do it until such time as I saw it coming on the floor in a manner that restricted debate. I called the State Department, and they said, oh, Rangel, I forgot to tell you, we're supporting the bill. I said, I don't believe this. And I went into detail with the conversations and the briefings I had by state. They said, oh, no, your boy Clinton changed his mind in Miami, and we're changing our mind in Washington. So Clinton really was against Torricelli, as was Bush. But when the Clinton handlers in Florida decided that it would be in his best interest to support it, the Bush administration changed its mind and supported it.
I mean, it also came at a very key time for the candidate, Bill Clinton. I think it was the time that the Jennifer Flowers scandal was blossoming, that his money was at an all-time low, and that he was being promised hundreds of thousands of dollars from Miami Cuban Americans.
That's correct. It was timing that did it. He desperately needed money at the time. The Cubans came through with it. And what happened is, if to back up what Congressman Rangel said at that time in Foreign Affairs magazine, Jean Kirkpatrick had written a big article against the Torricelli bill. And of course, it was out of date by the time it came out because everybody was for it at that time, thanks to Clinton.
It's interesting to note that every Secretary of State, Democrat, under Democratic administrations or Republicans, and everyone that had anything to do with the Latin American desk, say that the embargo in its present form is against our national interest. Of course, that includes Kissinger, it includes Eagleburger, and it includes Bernie Aronson, who was Assistant Secretary of State in the Bush administration. So with those who respect international law and value what we do in foreign and trade policy, they know that this is merely a political thing. And it's sad because no one is more of a politician than I am. I love it. But to get our foreign policy and our trade policy at the detriment of the United States, we are the leaders in encouraging trades, whether it's the general agreement on tariffs and taxes or whether it's the a North American Free Trade Agreement. That's our thing, and we hope to become a competitive leader. We can't do it unless everyone participates. And so if we want to break the spirit of trade with Cuba, now for us to bring in all of our trading partners that we worked so hard and getting to sign the agreement and say, unless you boycott Cuba, we got to penalize you. They're not afraid of being penalized. We can't use our courts to drag in all of these cases. Mind you, over $50,000, so we know which Cuban Americans we're trying to get their attention. It's a sad day in American history.
You're listening to New York Congressmember Charles Rangel. Also, we're joined in Miami by Frank Manitzas, who is former Latin American bureau chief for ABC News, covering Cuban politics for 35 years. And I want to bring Jane Franklin into the conversation, contributing editor to Cuba Update and author of The Cuban Revolution in the United States, A Chronological History. Jane, you've been documenting these moves over the years. How does the new Helms-Burton Act, which President Clinton is signing today, how does it increase the stranglehold from the so-called Cuba Democracy Act signed just a few years ago and introduced by Torricelli from New Jersey?
Well, it simply tightens the domestic regulations of that bill even more and takes it to the international community as well, as Congressman Rangel has pointed out here, and Frank Manitzas is dealing with the graffiti-like character of this bill. It is ludicrous, but unfortunately, it's also now all of these regulations are going to be codified into law. All these previous regulations and rules that had been the prerogative of the president will now be codified into law, and so our right to travel, our right to free trade, our fundamental rights are being codified into law as being violatable.
Meaning that the president will no longer have a deciding power here?
He will no longer be able to impose or lift these regulations, like the travel ban. For instance, the Carter administration was able to lift the travel ban, which is has to be reinforced every 6 months or goes out of existence. If this law goes far enough and they are able to codify this, which the law says they will, That means that those regulations will be part of our daily lives in a way that they weren't before. And it's interesting, Amy, on Democracy Now, because this puts Cuban policy into the hands of the far right, Jesse Helms and the Cuban American National Foundation. And the far right generally says they want to get the government off our backs, but they're the very ones that support legislation that intrudes even more against our fundamental human rights in this country. And I'd like to point out that in these international ramifications of this law that Congressman Rangel was talking about, that Jesse Helms is imposing his own agenda because he, by putting in here that the United States can deny entry to corporate officers and so on of these foreign firms who trade with Cuba, he is enforcing his own idea of what the CIA should be all about, which is international espionage. This is a period when the CIA's role is being reevaluated. Some people are even calling for an end to the CIA. Here, he's opening up this vast new area in which they can go to work. Plus, he's opposed to the arms control agreements with Russia and the former Soviet Union states. And so when he says that the United States will have to, when the law says that the United States will have to reduce aid to Russia by the amount that Russia gives to Cuba for the Lordi's listening station in Cuba, he's enacting something that's against START 1, which the arms control agreements give Russia the right to a listening post.
Congressman Rangel, let me ask you something. Why is it so easy to get something like this passed around Cuba, but when it comes to sanctions against governments like Indonesia, military dictatorships that kill their own people and the people they occupy, like these Timorese, governments like Nigeria, and sanctions also against the corporations that do work there, you don't have anything like this kind of frenzy that's developed in Washington?
Someone once asked a member of Congress, how many people in your congressional district support gun control? And he said, allegedly, about 85%. And they said, well, why do you always vote against gun control? He said, because the other 15% are organized. And I think that's the answer to your question. I don't recall any group as small as this group that really would advocate an invasion of Cuba to restore democracy, not as America understands it, but as they understand it, which includes the restoration of land which they thought was theirs. And Jorge Mascanosa, who is the leader of this group, will not deny that becoming president of the new Cuba, is off his agenda. So most people haven't the slightest idea where Cuba is or how it fits into anything. It is not on the list of priorities of any member of Congress. These people raise a whole lot of money, and politically they are vindictive. I was at a Democratic affair last night, and a Cuban-American belonging to the foundation who had come into my office in Harlem in New York a couple of years ago to make it clear that either I was going to eat the honey out of a jar, imaginary jar, or they hit me in the head with it. And it turns out that I found out later that my opponent in the Democratic primary, 85% of his money came from the Cuban-American community, and he had no relationship with Cuba, and reversed his position on the embargo to get the money. And last night, the guy told me that they could do it again. And so no one wants a headache if they can avoid it. And they actually help people who help them and try to hurt people who disagree with them. It's a very tight, well-financed organization that can turn out people at the drop of a hat and intimidate people.
Interesting.
And the bottom line to your question is, most politicians would say, who needs the aggravation? Who cares?
Congressman Rangel, we're going to have to cut you off here. We want to thank you very much for joining us from New York. We want to thank Frank Menitzis from Miami and from the primary state of Florida, and Jane Franklin, contributing editor to Cuba Update. Clearly, there is a debate within the establishment, that you don't see it today, with President Clinton about to approve tougher sanctions against Cuba. You've been listening to Democracy Now!, produced by Julie Drizin with Pat Greenfield. Our engineers are Kenneth Mason at WPFW here in Washington and Bob Cham in Houston at KPFT. For a cassette copy of this program, call the Pacifica Archives at 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. For another edition of Democracy Now!, thank you for listening. I'm Amy Goodman.